the U.S. to allow Ukraine to use American-supplied weapons to attack inside Russian territory.
You know, we should have done this. We should have sent the attackers 18 or 24 months ago with no restrictions.
President Joe Biden is in South America.
So there's a sense of leaders wanting to know about the durability of U.S. commitment and whether the priorities of the incoming administration would drastically change.
And a look at some of Donald Trump's controversial cabinet picks.
Is this the very best that America has to offer for a moment like this with so many challenges that we confront? Of course not.
Today is Monday, November 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish. In a change of course, President Biden will allow Ukraine to use American-supplied weapons to strike deep into Russian territory. In Biden's final months of office, the move is a significant change to Washington's policy in the Ukraine-Russia conflict. The White House declined to comment. The move by the United States 2 months before President-elect Donald Trump takes office on January 20th follows months of requests by Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to allow Ukraine's military to use U.S. weapons to hit Russian military targets far from its border. So what changed Biden's mind? The change in policy follows Russia's deployment of North Korean ground troops to supplement its own forces, development that caused alarm in Washington and Kyiv. While some U.S. officials have expressed skepticism that allowing long-range strikes will change the war's overall trajectory, the decision could help Ukraine at a moment when Russian forces are making gains, and it could put Kyiv in a better negotiating position when and if ceasefire talks happen. What's not clear, though, is if Trump will reverse Biden's decision when he takes office. Trump has long criticized the scale of U.S. financial and military aid to Ukraine and has vowed to end the war quickly, though without explaining how. For his part, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky did not say much, and without explicitly confirming or denying the reports, he spoke confidently of the future.
But strikes are not carried out with words. Such things are not announced. Missiles will speak for themselves. They certainly will. Glory to Ukraine.
Slava Ukraini. For more perspective and analysis on Biden's change of course, I'm joined by John Herbst. He's senior director of the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center and a former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine.
I would call it good news, but way late and too little.
So too little, too late. I think that's a reasonable assessment. But given that we are where we are, is it better that Biden did this than continued to do nothing?
Of course. It's a plus. There's no doubt about it. But, you know, we should have done this. We should have sent the attackers 18 or 24 months ago with no restrictions. So, you know, we sent attackers, what, when we make the decision on attackers earlier this year, right, at the beginning of the year. And we should have made the decision. We should have allowed them to use them wherever when we made the decision. And it's been, you know, this has been typical of the Biden administration. They've been intimidated by Moscow's nuclear threats, and that has prevented them from making the sound decisions to help Ukraine on the battlefield.
But looking forward, how do you think they might change things, either for Ukraine or for Washington?
It's a bit better. I mean, this will give Ukraine the ability to strike that much farther into Russia, but let's be serious. It's a failure of the intellectual conversation that we call these deep strikes, because the long-range attackers go only, what, 180, 200 miles, right? And in a country that's 9,000 miles from east to west, to call that a deep strike is just ridiculous. We should be giving them, tomahawks, which can go, you know, 1,000-plus miles.
And given that President Biden is only going to be around for a couple more months, how do you see this changing after he leaves office?
Well, this is a plus. It's one decision that Trump does not need to take, right? So this is now the reality that Trump inherits. To his credit, Trump has said, you know, he's going to work this peace deal, and if Moscow refuses, then he'll arm Ukraine in a way it's never been armed before. I trust he means that. This, again, would not be Trump arming Ukraine as, you know, as it's never been armed before. This gives a new base baseline for Trump to improve on, you might say, if Moscow is not going to be helpful in rather constructive in responding to Trump. And I suspect it will not be constructive.
So what do you see Zelensky doing with his new abilities?
Well, one of the reasons why it's too late is the Russians already moved a lot of the critical stuff beyond the range of the longer range attacks, right? So there may be a few targets which will now be available that were not available before. But, you know, you might say the big hunting has already passed because of the Biden timidity, the Biden delay.
What about the North Koreans in Kursk?
Well, right, that's a suitable target, for sure. For sure. But, I mean, they were always meant to be part of the meat grinder.
How so?
Well, we see they've been thrown straight into combat. And we know that the Russians don't value the lives of the soldiers they send straight into combat. You know, they're there to die so that the line behind them can make minimal gains. That's been the whole Russian strategy for the last two plus years. And the North Koreans are part of that.
So you think Trump arming Ukraine like it's never been armed before would be good?
Oh, there's no doubt about that. Look, I do think there will be a negotiated peace of some time, but the only way you have the chance at a fair or a stable and a stable peace that will ensure security in Europe in the future, you have to make sure that Moscow is facing serious troubles on the battlefield. Now, that's why most of the commentary coming out of Moscow since Trump's been since his election and him talking about his peace initiative has been contemptuous. You know, like, we're doing well. We'll be happy to have peace once we have won on the battlefield, and the peace will be the peace we determine. There have been a lot of comments along those lines, including from relatively senior Russian officials, including the number two in the Federation Council, the upper chamber of their parliament.
So even if it is an incremental step, then Biden's moves today would be good.
I've said they're good. It's just I've pointed out how they could have been much better.
John Herbst is senior director of the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center and a former ambassador from the United States to Ukraine. Mr. Ambassador, thanks for your time today. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
It's been a busy weekend for President Biden. We've been hearing about his decision to grant Kyiv permission to use American-supplied weapons for deeper strikes into Russian territory. He's also been at the APEC conference in Lima, Peru, and he became the first sitting U.S. president to visit the Amazon rainforest. And on Monday, the G20 summit begins in Rio de Janeiro. Here to help catch us up on all of this is our White House bureau chief, Patsy Wita-Kuswara.
So he really wanted to mark what the White House calls his legacy on fighting climate change. And he couched it in economic terms, in terms of the race between countries and harnessing the clean energy revolution. So this was in Manaus, which is the capital of the state of Amazonas, which is a doorway to the world's largest jungle of forests. Where President Biden said that his administration in 2024 surpassed the goal of providing $11 billion per year in international climate financing. Of course, this is the key component in the fight against climate change.
And on Monday, he's in Rio de Janeiro for the G20 summit. What can we expect?
So the first, one of the first agendas in the G20 is to attend the launch of what is called the Global Alliance Against Hunger and Poverty. This is the Brazilian president's initiative to accelerate the fight against hunger and poverty by 2030. And of course, we will meet other leaders and discuss pressing issues of global concerns, climate change again. And he'll have a series of meetings with those leaders. But it's mostly summitry tomorrow before the bilateral meeting with President Lula that we're expecting also to happen sometime during this trip.
And what do we think President Lula and President Biden will discuss?
So their focus is on what President Lula is focused on for this summit, which is alleviating poverty, addressing climate change. There'll be, of course, some talks about trade. I mean, the countries here at the G20 are the 20 biggest economies in the world. And they're very focused in terms of, you know, the continuation of fighting back what COVID has done to their economies. And also to kind of align themselves in terms of tariffs and trade. Of course, this is something that a lot of leaders are questioning in terms of what the incoming U.S. administration might do. As you know, President Donald Trump launched a trade war during his first term, and he has threatened speed tariffs, not only on China, but also 10 to 20% for the rest of the world. So these are just some of the issues that will be in the focus tomorrow. And of course, again, this is a farewell tour of sorts for President Biden. This will be his last time at the global stage meeting these leaders. So it will be a little bit of that as well, saying goodbye to all of them.
So you touched on China earlier. I know President Xi is going to be at the G20. President Biden met with President Xi in Lima just a couple of days ago. How's that relationship and what are the two leaders discussing?
So these two leaders, of course, have had a lot of differences in the 4 years that President Biden was in office. Both leaders stressed that it is their responsibility not to allow competition between the U.S. and China to veer into conflict, because this is something that will be detrimental to the rest of the world. So they both did highlight ongoing areas of cooperation, including on counter-narcotics, as well as this new area of agreement on artificial intelligence. They agree on the need to maintain human control over the decision to use nuclear weapons. So that's new development. But it's not just all rosy pictures of cooperation. There's also new irritants as well as longstanding issues between the two countries that President Biden did raise. He warned China over its alleged role in hacking private telecommunication providers that are used by U.S. government officials and presidential campaign staff. And also raised the issue of Beijing's increased military activities around Taiwan and the South China Sea, its support for Moscow's war against Ukraine, and this other new development, which is the deployment of North Korean troops to aid Russia, which, according to President Biden, is a deeply dangerous development, not just for Europe, but also the stability of the Korean Peninsula.
And you also mentioned that, of course, President Donald Trump is coming back into office in a few short months. Is there a sense of other world leaders sort of not willing to negotiate or not wanting to make a deal with President Biden because anything they say can be undone when Trump returns?
Well, that is certainly the question that we members of the press who are traveling with President Biden have been asking the White House. Why is the president committing to all these climate change, poverty reduction, and other global issues when it may be a completely different set of priorities for the administration? And the response from the White House is that President Biden is just focusing on what he can do in the remainder of his term. Certainly a lot of questions among the leaders, because they saw that under the first Trump administration, the U.S. pulled out of many multilateral agreements, including the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, that's a free trade pact among many APEC members, as well as the Paris Climate Accord. So there's a sense of leaders wanting to know about the durability of U.S. commitment and whether the priorities of the incoming administration would drastically change.
Patsy Wiedekuswara is VOA's White House Bureau Chief. She's traveling with President Biden. We caught up with her in Brazil. Patsy, thanks for your time. Thanks for your reporting.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And here are some of the other stories we're following from around the world. Distractions were bigger than deals in the first week of the United Nations climate talks at COP29 in Baku, Azerbaijan. Little progress was made on the issue of how much money rich countries should pay to developed ones to move away from dirty fuels, and how to cope with rising seas and temperatures, and how to pay for damage already caused by climate-driven extreme weather. A stabbing attack at a vocational school in the eastern Chinese city of Wuxi on Saturday left 8 people dead and 17 others injured, local police said. The attack took place at the Wuxi Vocational Institute of Arts and Technology. The suspect is a 21-year-old male student named Xu, who was detained on site. Police said he had failed his examinations and could not graduate, and that he was dissatisfied about his pay at an internship. He decided to vent his frustrations via the attack, a police statement said. The arrest of a female student who undressed at the Islamic Azad University campus in Tehran brought Iran's strict dress code policies and controversial use of coercive psychiatric treatment back to the global spotlight. A young woman stripped down to her underwear and walked around the campus on November 2nd. Rights activists in the West said she was protesting the mandatory dress code for women, while Iranian officials and media have said she suffered a mental health breakdown instead. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. Back in the United States, some of President-elect Trump's cabinet picks are being described as controversial in both Democratic as well as Republican circles. Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson reminded critics Sunday that the American people voted to shake up the status quo, and that's what these new cabinet officials, if confirmed, will be tasked with doing. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias has the story.
President-elect Donald Trump continued making cabinet nominations during the weekend, including that of Chris Wright, an advocate for the oil and gas industry, who would serve as Secretary of Energy. Trump has prioritized political loyalists for key cabinet positions. One pick in particular, that of former Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz as Attorney General, continues to stir controversy. Before Gaetz resigned last week, a House Ethics Committee had been investigating whether he engaged in sexual misconduct and illicit drug use. Gaetz denies the accusations. Democratic Senator Adam Schiff told CNN's State of the Union that Gaetz, in his view, is unqualified to serve in the proposed role.
Are we really going to have an attorney general who there's credible allegations he was involved in child sex trafficking, potential illicit drug use, obstruction of investigation, who has no experience serving in the Justice Department, only being investigated by it?
Republican Senator Mark Wayne Mullen believes the Senate should have access to the investigation findings, but told NBC's Meet the Press that Gaetz deserves a fair chance of being confirmed for the role.
I have no doubt that President Trump believes that Matt Gaetz is the right person to do the right job. Matt will be treated the same as every nominee out there.
The House Minority Leader, Democratic Representative Hakeem Jeffries, also appeared Sunday on NBC. He questioned President-elect Trump's cabinet picks, some of whom lack experience related to their proposed roles.
Is this the very best that America has to offer for a moment like this, with so many challenges that we confront? So, of course not.
With their votes to elect Donald Trump, the American people have given the Republicans the mandate to shake up the status quo, underscored the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Republican Mike Johnson. He spoke on CNN's State of the Union.
Any president has the right to name their own cabinet, to nominate persons that they think will fulfill their agenda. And the people that are on this list will do that. They will go into the agencies that they're being asked to lead, and they will reform them.
It is expected that most of Trump's cabinet picks will win quick Senate approval after confirmation hearings. The president-elect has also called on Senate Republican leaders to allow him to make recess appointments, which would erase the need for the hearings. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
There's a lot going on during the change of a presidential administration, and cabinet picks, like we just heard, are but one small, albeit very public, part of it. As Trump gets ready to take office, a carefully coordinated process is underway behind the scenes to transfer power from the outgoing administration to the new one. Experts share their perspectives on how the federal government prepares for this pivotal moment in American democracy. VOA's Salem Solomon has more.
And I appreciate very much a transition that's so smooth. It'll be as smooth as it can get, and I very much appreciate that, Jim.
A peaceful transfer of power, an enduring tradition, a solemn promise, and an important component of American democracy. After a U.S. president is elected, there is a flurry of activity before he or she is sworn in. 76 days from the election to inauguration may sound like plenty of time, but the transition from one administration to the next is anything but simple, says Michael Shurkin, who had served on the National Security Council and is now the Global Programs Director at 14 North Strategies, a business advisory firm.
We want to make sure that the president succeeds. So if they want to review the policy, we're going to help them do that by telling them what we know and explaining to them what's going on.
The president-elect doesn't officially take office until January 20th, but planning must begin much earlier, says Valerie Smith Boyd with the Center for Presidential Transition.
So it is a tremendously large task. And the first thing that our organization has done is try to encourage presidential candidates to start that planning process in the spring of an election year. Of course, they have a big focus on winning the election, but they also need to establish a separate organization that is looking at how to vet hundreds of thousands of resumes to select exactly the right people to convert their policy promises into action.
Filling government positions is no small task. Many of the positions require Senate confirmation, while others must be vetted for classified security clearance, creating a delicate time, Boyd says.
We do see times of transition as a period of vulnerability for the nation because political appointees, senior leaders are leaving one administration. There may be delays in new people coming on board. And of course, that can create some challenges in communication or understanding roles and responsibilities.
The U.S. has a long-standing tradition of peaceful power transitions dating back to the first in 1797 when George Washington handed the presidency to John Adams. At the heart of successful transfer of power, Boyd says, is clear and effective communication.
So a peaceful transfer of power at its best looks like an incoming and outgoing team sharing information and working closely together to protect the country and the world from very serious risks.
Shurkin emphasizes that ultimately a smooth-running democracy is more important than who wins the election.
For democracy to function, everybody has to, at a certain level, understand that as long as the system works, the system is sort of more important than they are. So the success, the health of the system is more important than whether or not your guy won or lost the election. And I think that has historically been an important reason why American democracy has been so stable and so relatively successful.
As the nation prepares for the next presidential inauguration, the transition process is a reminder of the people behind the scenes who make democracy work. Salem Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
And finally today, a look at the latest on Italy's controversial immigration plan. The policy of holding migrants in detention centers in Albania for processing has hit a legal roadblock, as judges in Rome referred the case to the European Union's Court of Justice, which could take months or years to make a ruling. VOA's Henry Ridgewell has that story.
Italy has built two migrant detention centers in Albania. Rome's plan was to fast-track the asylum applications of migrants rescued in international waters, and those who fail would quickly be returned to their countries of origin. Italy hoped to process 3,000 migrants a month at the centers, a major deterrent for irregular migration. But so far, just 24 migrants from Egypt and Bangladesh have arrived, and all have since been sent back to the Italian mainland on the orders of a court in Rome. The judges cited a recent European Union Court of Justice ruling that no country of origin could be deemed safe if parts of it were dangerous. The Italian judges are now seeking further clarification on that definition. EU law takes precedence over domestic legislation. Judges at the European Court of Justice could take months to decide. It's a big setback for the flagship policy of Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, who disputes the Italian judge's interpretation. Speaking last month, she said the Albania agreement was groundbreaking.
This is a new, courageous, unprecedented path, but one that perfectly reflects the European spirit.
Italy has long been on the front line of Europe's migration crisis. Just over 58,000 irregular migrants have arrived by sea so far this year, although that's 60% down on 2023. Across the EU, governments are under pressure to cut immigration, with several eyeing deals like that between Italy and Albania to process migrants in third countries. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
And that'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karish.